It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to the Wisconsinite who made a big splash in an NPR recipe contest. We'll hear the story behind her award-winning coleslaw.
Our next guest has lots of suggestions to help make us less dumb. He says our mind misleads us in many ways, but with some effort, we can avoid some of the most common mental stumbling blocks.
David McRaney joins us now. His blog is You Are Not So Smart. His new book is You Are Now Less Dumb. You can join in if you have questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we tend to think of our brains as these reliable, rational machines. How wrong are we?
We're pretty wrong. I mean, the brain is this amazing, organ, and it does these amazing things, and it's provided us with all this great stuff that you see around you, the computers, the phones, the transportation, the technology, the medicine. But that same brain is also very prone to some well-known, well-researched, and predictable stumbling blocks, and I tend to focus on sort of three arenas in the stumbling blocks, biases, fallacies, and heuristics. And when you focus on that stuff, you start to realize two really central truths about who we are, and that's you and I, all of us, we're sort of unreliable narrators in the story of our own lives. And that's because we're generally unaware of how unaware we are, but we have a kind of an overconfidence, a refusal to accept that as part of who we are. But you see it in studies, and it's easy to tease out of people. And once you see it in other people, you tend to see it in yourself, too.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you, I mean, before we dive into what some of these misconceptions are, how did you figure out where to put your focus? If you are part of the collective group that is unaware of how unaware you are, how did you become aware?
Well, you know, I came through this sort of through backwards engineering. I had I remember very specifically, I thought I was going to be a psychologist. You know, I took all the classes like a lot of people did in college, but then switched over to journalism once I got a couple bylines in the school newspaper and realized, oh wow, that's really fun. But the I never lost like a love for it or a love of checking out new and interesting things on the internet. And I very plainly remember seeing the Darren Brown person switching experiment. It's a famous experiment in psychology, but he made it into sort of a magic trick where someone is asking for directions, and then two people walk between that person and the person who is talking to them, and with like a large painting or something, and then they switch places. So now the person who was previously asking that person question, asking for directions, has been switched with a completely different person, yet the other person never seems to notice. And in research, it's actually around like 30 or so percent of people don't notice. But I was like, that is unbelievable. And that started me down the path of trying to figure out, well, is there like a branch of psychology that only studies how flawed we are? And it turns out, yeah, there are several places in psychology to do that. And that led me to find sort of all the things that I focus on the blog and that became the books.
If we can't rely on our brains, if our brains make these same mistakes and we know they're going to make those mistakes, are we just doomed? Are we just going to do this again and again?
Well, it's, I think it's more, the way to go about using this in like a prescriptive way is not to try to remove these things from who you are. It'd be like trying to remove your eyeballs because they can't see in infrared. This is just what we are. This is just how the brain was built by evolution and how it reacted to pressures, selective pressures over the course of our history on this planet. And it's better to just accept and understand and know that this stuff is true so that we can build lives and sort of build institutions around what we can expect ourselves to do in certain situations. Instead of assuming that we're going to do the right thing and the correct thing and the rational thing, we should be able to say, well, okay, not in every situation. And it looks like we're getting into one of those situations that we ought to look out for X. And I try to describe a lot of those X's.
Well, let's dig in then. You write that one misconception is that we always know why we feel the way we feel.
Right. That's one of the major themes of both books. One of the major themes of this whole project is that there are many different theories in psychology that attempt to explain why this is, but the truth of it is always there, and that is we often are just observers of our own behavior. We notice that we're feeling uneasy, or we notice that we're feeling happy, or or we find ourselves to be angry, and then we try to come up with an explanation. Well, why is that so? And we tend to always come up with an explanation for why we feel the way we feel. But when you put people in the lab, you see that it's not always accurate. Sometimes that story corresponds to reality, and sometimes it doesn't. And probably the most famous example of that I write about in the book is the Capilano Canyon study, where they had a woman stand in the middle of the Capilano Canyon suspension bridge, and it's this very scary, like something out of Indiana Jones kind of bridge, you know. And as you walk across it, you can really feel it shake and sway. And they had this woman in the center of the bridge. As men passed by her, she would ask some of them if they would mind filling out a survey for science. And at the end of the questionnaire, she said to them, "Okay, if you have any questions about what just happened here, just call me at this number." And she wrote down her number on a piece of paper and handed it over to them. Then they repeated that exact same experiment on a very safe and sturdy bridge over an area that didn't even really need a bridge. It was just there to look pretty. And they found that on the scary suspension bridge, the men were much more likely to call her back, and they were much more likely to assume that she had romantic interests in them. And so all the conditions were pretty much the same. And, you know, that kind of sounds like a messy study, but I can assure you they've repeated it in a zillion different ways in different experiments that are more controlled than that. And it's just that they were so scared. The psychology, they call it arousal, and not mm-hmm. sexual arousal, but just arousal, the kind of arousal you get when you, like, listen to a really stirring political speech or you're watching a very emotional movie. Whenever those men felt that really heightened state, they looked for a target, and in that situation, there was a very obvious target. And you'll see that over and over again with the human brain. When it can answer a very complicated and mysterious question with something that's not so mysterious, it will. And that's where we can, you know, in that situation, it's benign. In fact, I would say use it to your advantage. Go on a date, go on a roller coaster ride, or go get some coffee, and let those heightened states target you. But they can also be used by people who are out to do the nefarious things as well. And it's good to know that it's out there and it's part of you.
So is there a correlation then between these incorrect perceptions and hormonal response to situations?
You know, yes. Well, I mean, I'm not an expert in that, but I would say that just on what I know from what I've researched, that if something's happening inside of you chemically, and it's affecting your own, it's affecting your behavior, it's affecting your emotional state, you have no access to that. If you don't know that those sort of things are happening inside of your body, you may instead pinpoint the source of that as being something else in your life.
Hmm.
This really rings true for me, because I've discovered over the years, you know, if I'm getting crabby, say, never happens, but okay, once in a while, and I will start inventing the story. Oh, it's traffic making me crabby, or work stress or something. And then a while later, I realize I've had this headache starting for the last half hour. It slowly dawned on me, and that's probably what's been making me crabby. But I reach for some sort of external narrative, and that seems like it's another theme of what you're writing about.
Yeah, if you take a person who has had their corpus callosum split, that's a connective area between the two lobes of your brain. They do this for people who have severe epilepsy to prevent the seizure from passing across both lobes. They will the one part of your brain over in the left hemisphere, it's sort of the it is sort of the storyteller of the brain. We don't fully understand all this, you know, but very generally we understand that something's happening over there on that side that's telling the rest of the brain to a story. It's putting it, it's couching everything in a narrative. If you take someone like that and you make it so that only one eye can see, the eye that's not connected to that side of the brain, if you allow them to look at an image of a very terrible, gruesome car wreck, where people have been injured in this car wreck or have died in it, but that information is not available to that lobe of the brain that tells the story, the person will feel a queasiness. They will feel uneasy and terrible at what they're looking at. And then when you poll them, when you say to them, what's wrong? Why are you acting so strangely? They will say things like, I ate something bad for lunch, or it's very hot in this room. You think you could turn the air down a little bit? They will come up with all these explanations for why they feel the way they feel. Because the storytelling part of their brain doesn't have access to that terrible image the rest of their body has already seen and interacted to. So it's it's a physical thing that's happening. It's a very organic thing that's happening to you, and it's apparently very important for us as a creature with a very complicated nervous system that generates all these ideas like meaning and regret and shame, that we have sort of a storytelling engine that is always on to couch all that stuff, to provide a lattice for us to weave that story of who we are and give us a sense of self.
I'm talking to David McRaney about his new book, You Are Now Less Dumb. We're going to get into some of the other misconceptions that our brains lead us into in a minute, and you can join in if you have questions about how our minds get the world wrong sometimes. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret.
I'm Cynthia Schuster, and this is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. We're continuing our conversation with David McRaney, author of You Are Now Less Dumb, about the ways our mind deceives us.
You can join in if you have a question at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. David, let's get into another misconception you write about. We objectively appraise the individual attributes of other people.
Right. I think this one is really, I loved learning about this because I know it's one of those things that you see it, you say, okay, that should be common sense, but it really isn't. It's, I think if you start to try to quantify a person, like, you know, tease out different aspects of them, say, let's judge this person on their height, let's judge this person on their punctuality, and let's judge this person on their ability to cook broccoli very well. We have this intuition that what we will do is we will rate each one of those things on its individual merits. But what happens when you actually task people to do this is that when they rate something very highly on a list like that, they'll tend to rate everything else very highly as well. And if they rate something very poorly, they'll rate everything else very poorly as well. It just turns out whatever is the most salient thing about a person is the thing that colors everything else that we perceive about them.
So we key in on one thing, and that if it's good, that person's good regardless of everything else. If it's bad, boom, they're bad.
Right, and you think, you know, well, that can't possibly be true. I'm very meticulous about the way I judge people, but it doesn't seem that way. Whenever people, especially in situations like job interviews or in situations like performance reviews, you see this crop up a lot. And in experiments where they actually try to tease this out of people, it's amazing to see what happens. They in one experiment, they had people judge an essay, and so the essay is the exact same essay for two different groups of people. But one group of people, there's a photo attached to the essay that is of a very attractive woman, and they say that's the author of the essay. And the other essay is of a woman who, and this is the scientist talking, not me, is a very plain looking woman, and she is attached to that essay. Now the essay is the same, but the pictures are different. And the essay that has a beautiful woman attached to it is rated as being better written, deeper in its understanding of the source material, and so on. And whenever you then change that essay in a new experiment, everything else is the same, but you make the essay very poorly written on purpose, people tend to not only do what they did before, but they tend to, the gulf between the two ratings widens. And as the scientists say, because of the halo effect, you give beautiful people the benefit of the doubt, and then when they fail you, you also, you know, you give them more second chances, too. You forgive them. And there's probably nothing that generates the halo effect more dependably than beauty, and you can see it across a wide range of things.
Speaking of beautiful things, you talk about our clothing, and many of us just think of it as a practical thing we must have, maybe to shield the rest of the world from who we are. But you say that our clothes can actually impact our mental abilities. Can you tell us more about that?
They can, and this is very new research, and it's ongoing research, but it's sort of following this this line of investigation from an effect that was discovered not too long ago called priming. And priming is still being, you know, tackled by the scientific community, and they're seeing exactly how strong an effect it is. But we know that if you put a person in a room with a briefcase, and then you ask them to negotiate, then they will negotiate more aggressively than if you put them in a room with a backpack, a neutral item versus an item that primes them to think of business-related things. So these experimenters wanted to know, well, is there some way to make that even stronger? And there's already an effect called embodied cognition, where if a person is holding a warm cup of coffee, they will be more likely to consider the person they're speaking with to be a warm person, versus people who hold a cold cup of coffee will call the person they're speaking with maybe standoffish. In this experiment, what they did is they handed a white coat to one group of people, and they said, this is a painter's smock. And they handed the same white coat to a different group of people and said, this is a doctor's coat. And then a third group of people just looked at a doctor's coat in the corner and were asked to write an essay about it. And then afterward, all three groups are then put through a barrage of tests of mental agility, attention and problem solving, that sort of thing. And what they found was that the people who wore the white coat and believed it was a doctor's coat did better than the other two groups. And then the people who just looked at the doctor's coat did second best, and then the people who thought they were wearing a painter's smock did the worst of all. And it's insane because the coat is exactly the same in two groups. It's just the way what they associate it with changes. But putting it on, having it touch you, having it next to your skin is much more powerful than just thinking about it. So the effects that we get from the symbols that things are charged with, the power that we give objects through our association with them, is greatly magnified if we actually don those things as garments. And that's a new thing that psychology has only recently discovered.
Well, I know you said you're not prescribing anything here, but would I be better off coming to work and sitting down and doing interviews in a doctor's coat?
Yes, maybe. It probably would be more likely that you would do better in the role that you're trying to fulfill if you are donning the apparel associated with that role most strongly.
It's radio, man. I mean, we can wear anything.
I would say, put on the snazziest madman suit you can find, and you'll conduct yourself in a more proper way if that's what you're going for. But if not, you can go ahead and put on the Hawaiian shirt and flip-flops if that's what you want to go with.
Well, let's move along to the next misconception. I think we like to tend to think that we are inclusive, but are we hardwired to actually segregate ourselves into groups of us versus them?
I think that what happens is if you put people in like a cultural vacuum, then they will immediately begin to generate rules and mores and norms and cultural ideas, and those cultural ideas will start to become very important to that group. And then if that group of people faces another group of people who has a different set of values that formed out of that same vacuum, you will clash. It's sort of just the primate way. It's the social animal's way of surviving in a very harsh environment, and that's what we are. We've inherited all that stuff from our ancestors, and we are that kind of thing. We're very social creatures. And in one of the studies that I write about in the book, and this is a study that today would never ever be conducted because it's so unethical, but they sort of tried to recreate Lord of the Flies. I don't think they intentionally did it to recreate Lord of the Flies, but that's sort of what happened. They brought a lot of children, some boys, into the Oklahoma Robbers Cave State Park, and they had them. They didn't tell these two groups of boys that there were other people in the park. They all thought, each group thought they were the only people there. And they just sort of allowed them to generate their own small micro societies, and they were observing how those societies came about. And they, sure enough, they would come up with all these rituals and these things that they had to say at lunch and these things they had to do before they spoke to each other. And this hierarchy of command started to emerge just naturally, just out of nowhere. And then later on, they introduced those two groups to each other, and the experiment really was tilted on its ear very quickly, and they started having these raids back and forth, and they started trying to fight each other, and they ended up ending the experiment and stopping it before it could get really terrible and tough. But they found that they could bring those two groups back together again when they pretended that they couldn't get the truck going to get them out of the park, and everybody had to work together to get the truck going. And it sort of is a nice metaphor for the common enemy or the common problem that has to be faced. And that will bring groups together very reliably. So it's not so much that we are geared to oppose each other. It's just that we are very hardwired to create tight-knit social units and to avoid ostracism once we're in those things. And if we face another social unit that maybe is competing with us for resources or space, whatever, we tend to be a little aggressive.
Just a minute or so left. You've been looking at this stuff for a long time now. How has it changed the way you live? Are you always second-guessing yourself?
Not as much as I ought to. But, No, this hasn't made me superhuman or anything like that. It does. It has made me far more skeptical, and has really helped me to understand the value of disconfirmation. I think if there's any one great lesson that you learn once you start to read about all this stuff, is that a surer path toward the truth, or a surer path toward understanding yourself, is to take the things that you your preconceived notions and really subject them to some sort of disconfirmatory, harsh light. Because with the power of Google and the internet, if no matter what it is that you believe, whether it's political or whether it's scientific or whether it's just folklore, I mean, if you just think that maybe men did not land on the moon, that's all made up and it's some sort of conspiracy, you can use the internet to confirm that belief. It's very easy. And our natural predilection is to do that, is to go for confirmation whenever we have the opportunity. But
well, thank you, David, so much for shedding some light on that. That was David McRaney, author of You Are Now Less Dumb.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. I'm with Cynthia Schuster on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in this week for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on the show, a new Wisconsin map exhibit tells us the story of who we are.
But first, we'll find out how a disastrous trip to Mexico inspired a fresh and delicious recipe that gives coleslaw a bit of a Mexican twist.
That innovative recipe landed our guest the top prize in NPR's Taste of Summer Recipe Contest.
Patricia Mulvey lives in Madison, and she's chef and co-owner of Local Time, a CSA and Farmers Market Meal Planning Service. She joins us today to share some of her culinary secrets. Patricia, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. But I do have to point out, I didn't win the top prize.
Well, not the top prize.
No, oh. I was one of the top three.
Top three.
Oh, there we go. Well,
you won the important prize.
Thank you. Actually, a prize I did win that I hadn't anticipated was they've invited me to come back on the show in September on nice. NPR's Found Recipes again. So.
Great.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, as Rob mentioned, your recipe gives us a new twist on coleslaw. Tell us what an Ensenada slaw is.
I don't know if the name Ensenada slaw exists in Ensenada or not, but in Ensenada, almost any restaurant that you go to has this really delicious slaw that they tend to put on things like their fish tacos, and other such fresh dishes. And what makes it really delicious is it's got a little bit of lime juice for acidity, a little bit of hot sauce for some heat. And then I actually wrote the recipe using mayonnaise. That's how I developed it. But somebody since pointed out to me that they think it's actually made with crema, which is a Mexican thickened cream. So I'm going to have to try it that way, too.
Now, what I love about the recipe is the story behind it. What this could take a bit, but it's a crazy story that led to this funky coleslaw.
So yes, and it's a very long story because it was a whole entire weekend's worth of adventures. And Melissa Gray on Found Recipes did an amazing job of compacting it and editing it down to just a few minutes. I'll do my best too. But we were visiting a friend in San Diego, and we borrowed his car. My husband and I, and we drove down to Mexico, where we discovered that they use giant boulders as indicators that there's a construction zone ahead. And we discovered that by crashing into the boulder at about 60 miles an hour. There was a big dump truck in front of us, so it had enough clearance. We didn't see it coming. And so I decided not to crash into the oncoming cars to the left and not to dive off the cliff to the right. And I sacrificed the bottom of my friend's car for this. And oh, we then had one thing after the next go wrong. I jumped out of the car. I waved down a tar rolling machine yelling, "Hay un gran pierna en la calle," which means there's a big leg in the street. I think I meant to say piedra, which means stone, which isn't right either, but it was closer. And then one thing after the next led to 3 days stuck in Ensenada, where we eventually gave up and left the car and went back and told our friend where his car was.
Oh, no. Yeah. But you got the slaw out of this because you were eating this maybe all 3 days?
Yes. Actually, we did go to the same restaurant every night because it was so good. And there's this beautiful mariachi band. They played Bésame Mucho. And we discovered this unbelievably tasty slaw. And then I figured out how to make it.
Nice. How often do life events like that unexpectedly inspire your recipes?
Fortunately, I haven't had too many other life
events
quite like that one. But I do a lot of creating based on where I eat and travels and we travel a fair amount. And so I'm forever trying to figure out the flavor profile and recreate recipes when
and
I come home.
And how did you solve that mystery when you got home? How did you recreate
Well, I remembered that it was acidic, so I assumed it would be lime juice, so that was easy right off the bat. I tried making the heat with hot peppers and didn't like that as much. It had the wrong flavor, and I just played with it until I found the Tabasco and realized that was the right flavor.
You do this a lot. You kind of reverse engineer recipes. You eat something somewhere and then, all right, how did they do that? And go home and try to figure it out?
All the time.
How often does it end in disaster?
Oh, boy. Honestly, I don't know. Does it end in disaster very often?
Usually come up with something pretty good?
I can usually come up with something pretty good. I am a trained professional.
Of course.
You know.
Disasters are our sort of thing, Rob.
Yeah, that's more my kind of cooking. Anyway, you say put this on the fish tacos. That's the best way to eat it?
I love it right on top of the taco. I usually do it on a soft tortilla, and I'll put the slaw right in on top of it and roll it up and eat it that way.
If I try to make it at home, what kind of fish, how should I prepare it for the taco?
I like it with halibut, but that's a little bit costly, so you might want to go with something like a cod or another flaky white fish. And it's just a very simple spice rub, too, on there, and that's, I think that was cumin, lime, garlic. I don't have the whole thing off the top of my head, I don't think. But just a really nice sort of adobo-style spice rub, and pan sear that, and simple.
Do you find that people have a hard time figuring out what to do with cabbage besides a coleslaw? And where should they, I mean, what kind of ideas do you have?
Hold on, let me get a pen and paper. Yeah. I have two big heads of cabbage at home.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing when you see a beautiful little head of cabbage and then you start to slice it and it gets bigger somehow. I don't know how it grows when you cut it, but it's actually really funny. What I do for a living and at local time where we do farmers market meal planning and CSA meal planning is we solve that problem for people. We write recipes that use up all the vegetables that come in their box or that use whatever's being highlighted at the farmers market that particular week. And cabbage cooks beautifully. I love cabbage in soups. I love cabbage in stews. And it really wilts down. And so that's a good way to manage the volume is to cook it. And I also really love to preserve food. So make a sauerkraut. Just rub it with salt and let it sit.
Well, I've talked to my Polish grandparents about making sauerkraut, and they have this very long thing that involves smells and a wooden barrel with a weight on it. There's an easy way to make sauerkraut?
Well, that's no. It's not easy in that it doesn't involve smells and that it does get smelly. But you don't have to do anything once you put the salt in. You weight it down and allow the process to happen. And eventually, if you can stand the smell, eventually it turns into a very delectable product.
Could you treat it like lettuce? And I guess in my mind, I'm kind of equating your ensenada slaw to a little bit of a salad where you put in some, I wouldn't think to put hot sauce in it, for example. So what kinds of other flavors should we try to inject into recipes like this?
You know, there's a really great cookbook that I just worked on. It's called Farm Fresh and Fast, and it's a fundraiser for the CSA Coalition. And one thing that we do in there is we talk about variations on recipes. And so we do a master concept, so a master recipe for a slaw, which gives you a basic outline, but then it gives you maybe 8 different flavor profiles that you can add in. So if you take the flavor profile of any country, say Indonesia, which is going to have molasses and peanuts and a little bit of a sweet soy, that's a slaw recipe right there. Take the flavor profile of Greece and you put in some dill and some lemon and some olive oil and some feta, and there's a whole different slaw. So you can just sort of bounce those different types of flavor profiles around to create different toppings.
Nice.
So you can just kind of wing it, like, all right, I'm going to go Indonesian today. I've got these ingredients.
Yep, very much so.
Well, that sounds fun. I should check that out. So I want to know, you were in this contest. Has fame changed you now? Are you getting a lot of attention?
I don't think I'm famous. actually, the week of the contest, there were quite a few phone calls from reporters and all of that sort of thing. That was fun. it's nice to try to get the word out about the company and the work that we're doing, because I think people really could benefit from having access to our online source of really good recipes that focus on vegetables.
Well, where can people find more recipes before their next trip to the farmer's market?
Localtime.net.
And that's time spelled like
T-H-Y-M-E.
The herb, yes.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Patricia Mulvey, she runs, she's the co-owner and chef for Local Time, a CSA and farmer's market meal planning service based in Madison. You can find Patricia's award-winning recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll look at a new exhibit at the Wisconsin Historical Society about the maps that tell us who and where we are. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Noah. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Maps tell us a lot more than how to get from point A to point B. They tell us things like what their makers think are important.
Like the number of logging trails in Wisconsin or a water route to take from point A to point B.
The Wisconsin Historical Society opened its maps exhibit in April, and it will be closing this fall. So we'll be taking a last look at it today.
David Driscoll joins us. He's curator of business and technology at the Wisconsin Historical Society. David, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
When are most of the maps from in your exhibit?
It's hard to answer because there are two phases of the exhibition. The part that went up in the spring covers a great deal of time from the early 19th century up to today. The enhanced version that we sometimes call the treasures version that went in at the beginning of the summer features some of our oldest and rarest materials, and those go back to, I think, the earliest map we have is 1513.
And what is that map, the 1513?
That is a map of the world done by Martin Waldseemüller, who was a, German cartographer, who was basing the map on the map of the world done by Ptolemy in the ancient world, updated with the most recent information he had about explorations.
And some gaps in there, I'm assuming, along the way.
Yes, it's inaccurate, shall we say.
Now, I was going through a list of a lot of the maps there, and there really are different ways of looking at the world. And just for example, in the last few weeks, I've been up in Tomahawk, on the Wisconsin River, and in La Crosse, on the Mississippi, over in Milwaukee at the Art Museum overlooking Lake Michigan. And it just makes me think about the huge role water plays in shaping the world, of course, and our state in particular. You've got some water-oriented maps in the exhibit, I think.
Well, that was one of the first things that I thought of. Sort of before the highway maps and the systems that we're familiar, the graphic systems we're familiar with today, what the first European explorers looked at was the waterways, how to get from here to there, because there were no roads, railroads, that sort of thing. And actually, one of my favorite maps is a modern one that's kind of done in the style of the London subway map that most people are probably familiar with. But it's the river systems of the upper Midwest. And the fellow that designed that, who's a Madisonian, was explicitly thinking of waterways as travel routes and put a kind of modern graphic design spin on that. So we have some very early explorers' maps of the upper Midwest waterways, as well as some very contemporary ones.
I love looking at maps of rivers and thinking about the world that way, because right now, of course, we look at a map and the main feature on it is the highway system. And it's just, yes. It seems it's a totally different worldview in how you get from place to place.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I like about those early maps is that there are no kind of state boundaries. We're so used to thinking of there's a huge difference between us and Illinois. But when you actually look at river systems, it's all kind of integrated. It's not, kind of geographically separate.
Yeah, some of the borders make sense, of course. Lake Michigan over there and Lake Superior up there, the Mississippi over there. But maps are so subject to political whim sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Depending on where you are, we do have a map in up through September 7th in the treasures part. That kind of shows an early version of Wisconsin that sort of included Minneapolis, the Twin Cities, and also Chicago. And by the time the sort of political deal-making was done, Chicago was in Illinois and you know, we stopped shy of the Twin Cities.
And the Upper Peninsula was in Michigan for some reason.
Right, right. And that was part of the trade-off.
Right. Right. And then, of course, a lot of the maps were made not for travel or tourism, but for economic reasons. And one of the maps that interested me in the exhibit, logging trails. Not there anymore for the most part, but logging trails in Wisconsin.
Well, that's actually a fascinating map that wasn't done contemporaneously with those logging trails. This was a guy who realized years after the fact that there was tons of usually narrow gauge logging railroads throughout particularly the northern part of the state that were never recorded anywhere. So he took standard USGS survey maps and did a ton of research, walked through the woods following trails, and basically mapped all of this material in the 70s and 80s that there's just no evidence for anywhere else. And that's one of the points we're trying to make in the treasures phase. Some of the treasures are old, rare, and valuable. Others are treasures because of the incredible information that they carry.
It sounds like quite a bit of detective work there on that one.
Yeah, he worked for years on it. He was hoping to publish a book, but he died before that happened.
What are some of the other treasures that really caught your eye in the exhibit?
There's two ways to answer that. There's the old and rare and unusual, which most people would agree are treasures. Maps done by Hennepin or other explorers of the upper Midwest in the 1600s, early 1700s. And then there are others that I find I would call treasures just because they're so interesting. And there's a pair that we are including of sort of residential patterns by race in Milwaukee. And there are two versions of that. One maps that information by census tract. So there are blocks. And then there's another more recent version that does that using dots. And each dot represents 25 citizens. And on the block map, you get a real distinction of this neighborhood is white, this is black, this is Latino. On the dot map, the dots are much more interwoven and overlaid. And you just get a much more subtle view of what's actually happening in Milwaukee. And that's one of the points that I think was most fascinating about this project was what maps can tell you, what they don't tell you, and what the mapping techniques hide or reveal.
And that reminds me, you also have maps of immigrants in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
How do they tell that story?
That actually is a project that goes back to right around the turn of the last century. The earliest sort of Wisconsin ethnicity map was done in the 1890s. And I think that's kind of, that's the closing of the frontier, that's sort of leading into the immigration restriction era in the sort of early 20th century. And I think people are just starting to realize that Wisconsin is peopled by different European immigrants. And they're starting to map that. Later on, that became a project that the Department of Rural Sociology at the UW did. We have a number of maps that were generated through that effort. And it follows the same kinds of patterns as the earlier ones, but eventually they wind up being used for different purposes. And that information being sort of university public information was shared with the public. And one of the Milwaukee papers published a version of that just before World War II, before the U.S. entered World War II. And the whole subtext of that and the captions for the maps are, look how well America does at integrating different ethnic communities. And it's kind of, you know, in contrast to what's happening in Europe, this is a model of cooperation and peace and, you know, so it's kind of this propaganda thing in the context of the war. But it's very interesting, different use of that kind of information.
Now, looking to the future, I understand the Historical Society has digitized a lot of the maps in the collection. Tell us about that ongoing project.
That has been going on for, I guess, since about 2009. And there's the Casambas Foundation has funded that. So we've had people in the archives cataloging and digitizing maps. So we have high-resolution scans. We're up to about 3,000 of those now online. People can search the website and find all kinds of great stuff. On the other hand, there's nothing like seeing the real thing. So that's why we wanted to get the physical objects out, at least for a little while this summer.
And just briefly, tell us the where, when, and how long it's going of the exhibit.
The exhibition is up at the Wisconsin Historical Museum on Capitol Square, across from the Vets Museum at the end of State Street. And we're open 9 to 4, Tuesday through Saturday. The treasures portion of the exhibit will be up through September 7th, a Saturday. And the rest of the exhibition will be up through November 8th.
David, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Thanks very much.
That's David Driscoll, Curator of Business and Technology at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll be taking a new look at the Vietnam War with bestselling author Nick Terse.
We'll also hear about a new technology that could help cancer patients keep their hair during chemo.
And we'll talk about the budding startup community in Milwaukee.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.